Great to see you all. And anyway, life is not easy. This little, I decided a few months ago with during worship commission that I would use this little section here in the back of the Leader magazine. It's called Unity in Conflict. And so far I've given one sermon from this series that, and that's like 4 weeks ago by now. So this is the second series or second sermon in a series of sermons. And then next week, Ryan Aldrum will be here and he's preaching about whatever he wants to preach about next week. So the following two will be actually in June that we hear the following sermons. And in this, the first week, it was on the Genesis, the creation story chapter, but it was on God creating male and female in God's likeness and image. That was the first Sunday. So it was a theological foundation for our unity as people. Now, this Sunday, it's on conflict has the power to help us see and receive God. And then the first reading is the one that Jackie read from Psalm 121. And I don't know, is the mic, I was told a few weeks ago that if I'm going to ask questions, I should make sure that the mic is handy for people who say things because people on Zoom can't hear it. So when you look at Psalm 121, the question is, what is going on? We had both a psalm, the recorded song, and then we had the psalm itself. And the question is, what's going on? What is that psalm about? What is it actually saying? Psalm number 121. How do you, when you look at those words, what is the voice that you're hearing?
It is a song of ascent, ascents, as in going up the hill.
Yeah.
I lift up my eyes to the hills. From whence
Yes.
does my help come? That sort of thing.
Okay. Is that something you know is true, or is that just what you're saying?
I think I know that. I've known that since a child.
Okay,
I
well,
may be wrong.
see, this is what I'm getting at. Because what is going on? I wanted to bring some Egypt slides, but I didn't. I decided against it. But when we read this story of Esau in Genesis here, he builds pillars multiple times in these three chapters. So when there's that struggle with earlier, he sleeps and he has the dream, right, of the ascending, the angels going back and forth and so forth. Do you know what did he put his head on when he went to sleep? A stone. Then what did he do with the stone? He anointed it, but what did he do first? He stood it up. He stood up the stone and he anointed it, and they describe it as being a pillar. Now, that's the Egypt connection, There are all these obelisks. But then walking the other day, in our neighborhood, what's in the middle of a circle in the Rockets Landing neighborhood? There's an obelisk. And as you're driving to along 64 through Richmond, there or any of the cemeteries, I don't know, I haven't looked here, but we build pillars We're pillar builders. And if you remember from the Greece trip that we did a couple years ago, I took some pictures of shrines, fortresses on top of hills. And so this psalm, as I think about it, as I read it, we're on this little fine line, because the lyrics of the song leave it ambiguous, because it's not really saying, I look to the hills because that's where I'm going to receive my help. It's not really saying that. It's saying that what I imagine is going on there is, when we have mountaintop experiences, when we go somewhere and we say, I won't single out anybody, but somebody said they have their closeness to God when they're alone. And often what happened when Jesus was up on the mountain with the ascension, or with the disciples, and they all wanted to build tents, right? They had this experience with God, and they wanted to build an altar, put up a tent, because we want God to stay there. Well, in ancient times, this was also true. And the hills were covered with shrines, temples to gods. And in this story, it's, you know, I'm not saying it's wrong, that interpretation, because it's the dominant interpretation. But the difference between looking to the hills, it's not a question of looking to the hills and that's where my help comes from. I look to the hills and I say, where does my help come from? Not from these shrines up on the hills. My help comes from God. And it's just a subtle, subtle difference in a lot of ways. When I read this first, in their little study guide, I thought, what in the heck does the one story have to do with the other? But then I got thinking about how it is that we tend to be altar building people. We have an experience and we want to build a shrine to it. You know, we say, you know, I have a friend who loves Disneyland, and they just go all the time. And they posted that some people ask us why we always go to Disneyland. And the person, their response to these people who ask is, because we love it and we think it's such a cool place. You know, we tend to want to relive experiences. And Disneyland for that family provides an experience. And so it's just like an altar in a sense, from my point of view, that when we have a significant experience and we want to reconnect with that experience, we build an altar. We go there again. We do whatever. Now, to get to the reading for today, I have to say again, we have to ask the question, what is going on? The short for that is Wiggo. It's a Czechoslovakian philosopher that likes to say Wiggo. But anyway, it means, what is going on? And in this story here, Jacob is the brother, and he's experiencing a great deal of apprehension over going to see his brother Esau. Why does he have such apprehension? Okay, we need that loud enough. What did he say? What did you say?
I'm sorry. He took his brother's birthright.
Now, how did he do that?
He pretended he was him, and his father thought it was him and blessed him.
Well, what's the difference between Jacob and Esau?
Their name.
No. Yeah. You're so sassy. What's the difference between the two? Yeah. One's hairy.
One was loved more by his mother than his, and his father couldn't see that.
Who was loved by whom most? Who came out first? They're twins, right?
Yeah, but I forgot that part.
Yeah. So one was coming out first, and then the other grabs the heel and slips out first, right? Who is first? Esau was supposed to be first. Now we're getting all confused. Esau was first. So Esau grabbed Jacob's heel? That's what I was thinking. It's Jacob who grabbed the heel. Okay. Anyway, the point of it is that right from the womb, they had animosity. There was conflict already in the womb. And I've misread this even yesterday. I misread it. Because in my mind, I was thinking it's got to be Jacob, the one who grabbed the heel, that got out first. But he didn't, because Esau got out first. What's that?
Harry.
Well, that's later. Okay, so it's as if trying to pull him back. Okay, I'm sorry. Sorry about that confusion, because I made more confusing than I sorted out there. But what Jacob, the thing is, though, if we read this story, these several chapters, the thing that we get, I gave the wrong name to this story, this sermon, because it really should be in pursuit of a blessing. You know, because Jacob, all along, even from his prenatal infancy, was in pursuit of a blessing. And his brother starts sliding out first, and he says, I want to grab on, and I want to get that blessing, because it's for me. And then how many years later, he's an adult, and he goes to his dad, or no, his mother, Rebecca, no, Rachel, overhears, now I'm doubting my memory, she overhears the conversation that Jacob or Esau is going out to get some meat and bring it to his dad, and then his dad will bless him, right? So what's the dynamic here? When have we, what is Jacob and what is Esau? Esau is a hunter. So what does that make Jacob? A farmer. So Jacob and Esau, there's a tension here in the story between agrarian, pastoral versus hunters and gatherers. So there's a tension there. And where have we also experienced that same tension? Cain and Abel, there you go. There's a straight line there between Cain and Abel. And who killed whom? Why? Yeah, Abel's sacrifice was respected more. And the thing is, what is the difference in that story? I know I said this one time a good while back. But in that story, we tend to look at it as in terms of meat versus grain and so forth. But that's not really a good reading of the story. because the story says that Cain brought some of the grain. Let's go out to the field, and when they so he says, Abel for his part brought the firstlings of his flock, their fatted portion. So what does that mean? It's not sloppy seconds or any kind of thing like that, is it? It is the first fruit of the first fruit, or the best fruit of the first fruit. You know what I'm saying? So with the offering that Abel brought, he took great care. But when you get to Cain, it says, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. God had no regard for Cain's offering. So Cain went away very angry. But I'm missing the line that I'm after. Okay, Cain brought the Lord the offering, an offering of the fruit. This is the verse 3, sorry. I wasn't planning on reading this. But in the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. Is that the first fruit? Does that imply any care whatsoever? No. You know, if to do really a first fruit thing, he would have had to been sitting there watching the grain ripen and just seeing when it's starting to tip. Because now it's too heavy for the stem. And now he goes around and he only picks those that are actually ripe. That's ripe. That's an equivalent thing. You know, so it's the first of the first in that harvest of the wheat or grain, whatever. Same thing with the animal. We've got this animosity between herds people and hunters. That's within the Genesis text, right? Between Cain and Abel, and now we see it again in Jacob and Esau. And Esau has stolen or had the blessing of his father taken from him because of Jacob. He put on a skin, he went in, and he received the blessing because his mother had said, hey, go get this ready, make a good sauce, and take it in, and you'll get the blessing. And now, all these years later, Jacob is wanting to go out and meet Esau. He needs to leave the land of his father and go out. And so he takes all of this, and remember there, this is the story with Laban. And Laban, you know, Jacob wanted to marry Rachel, and he worked for his father-in-law for years. And then what happens? He gets the oldest daughter, Leah. He was tricked. Now, this is a treacherous story. You know, it's just really, they're nasty in it. And we get, so he stays and works longer so that he has both Leah and Rachel. And he has all these children with the two of them. But now he's going to reconcile with his brother. And he's very anxious about the whole affair. He sends everyone, the wives, the flocks, the maids, the children, cross the ford of the river before him. And they go, and then Jacob stays on the other side of the river. And there's this encounter. And in this encounter, he wrestles the person. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled him with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, He struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." So the man that he wrestled said, "Let me go." And Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So Jacob got the blessing the first time around. And here he has this wrestle with this man. He fights with him through the night. And what happens? He says, "You must bless me too." So Jacob, this is the third time at least that we see him fighting for a blessing. And how do we look at that? He earns this one because he fought all night. But what's interesting here is that just a little bit earlier, he had had this encounter dream with the angels ascending and descending the stairs, and he puts up a pillar, an altar, a stone, because this is the place I met God, he says. Well, now here, he meets God in a person, and he wrestles with him. He struggles with him through the night. Now, how does this make us think about who God is? You know, the reason I wanted to bring a few pictures of statues in Egypt and so forth is, but I didn't want to get too political given this era right now that we're living in. But the kings would build huge statues of themselves and place them where everybody could see them. Stone statues of themselves. Was that statue the king? Knew. It was just a semblance of him. And a lot of the time they put them at their grave sites. You know, they'd put those temples, they'd make temples with their statues in front of the temples. And so these were not to be worshiped. They would also make temples for worship. So it wasn't really their statue that was being worshiped, but they were making worship spaces. And anyway, as I was contemplating this story, the thing that came to me most clearly is that we have a God who actually invites us to wrestle with God. I don't know if you've read the book from years back called A Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck. Do you remember? Did you read that? Well, one of the stories there, he's doing therapy. He used to do group dynamics work, group therapy, and so forth. And anyway, he tells a story about working with a child who was having real adjustment difficulties. And after a while, you know, the child is there and the child's father is there. And at a certain point, Peck gets down on the floor and wrestles with the boy. And the point of the story, as I recall it from 35 years ago, was that the father was struck as he watched the therapist wrestle, playfully wrestle, with his son, and he realized, I have never made myself that vulnerable to my child. I've always had a barrier between me and my child. And so here in this story, on the one hand, in scripture, no one has ever seen God. But here, when Jacob encounters this stranger and wrestles with the stranger all night long, and then the stranger wants to leave, but throws his joint out of whack, the stranger has done this to him, And Jacob realizes that I've been wrestling with God. You may find that this master's program in the end is another version of wrestling with God. You know, because many times in life, it's when we go through our big struggles, we come out the other side and we feel like I understand God more right now than I ever have before. I have a Dutch twin brother. He was born same day, same year as I was. And he's going through leukemia. And he Friday had the chemotherapy that kills everything. And so right now he's extremely vulnerable. And tomorrow he's getting the stem cells that were taken from his body and incubated. Those are going to be put back into his bones, I guess. I'm not at all sure how that works. But the thing that is so interesting to me in this is that in the years that we were together, we worked not together in Benin, but that's where we got to know each other. And then we've visited, he and Yvonne have come here and we've gone there and so forth. We've visited over the years, but we've rarely talked about faith. Rarely talked about faith. But when we get into this time where he's dealing with leukemia, we have spoken about faith more through text messages, through chats, than ever before. And so in this encounter with his own finitude, he's feeling freer to talk about his faith and what he believes. So it's often in the midst of struggle that we redefine and re-understand our relationship with God. So it's not that we need to invite struggle on, but we need to realize that it's often through struggle that we are transformed. You know, so Chris in Sunday school was asking, does this Holy Spirit continue to work today? Well, I think we experience the Spirit of God working in our lives frequently in the midst of conflict, especially conflict where we feel like we're never going to get out of this. That's where God comes to us, but God doesn't remove the problem. I've said this, I think, before here. Electricity, to get those bulbs glowing, or when you're doing plumbing, to get the water to flow right, to have the right pressure, you have to have resistance, right? So you make the pipes smaller and smaller, and then it comes out with force at the end. Same thing with electricity. There's got to be that resistance for electricity to flow. Then in thinking about that too, there's that expression about opposites attract. Well, why do opposites attract? Well, in coming together, we complete each other. We become more complete in opposition. I don't know if you agree or not, but I'm putting it out there. And I think it comes from this story. So we are not asked to avoid conflict. We're not asked to seek conflict. But we are invited to look and understand the way that God works through conflict. So we wrestle, we struggle with God through the night if that's what it takes. But when we get to the other side, we can see, no, this is something that has come from God that is transforming me. And that's different in my mind from saying that God brought this upon me. You know, like I'm just not one that believes that God sends us illness in a way to punish us and stuff like that. No, but we encounter illness, we encounter difficulties, we encounter obstacles, and that's an invitation to struggle there with God, with our self-understanding and with the situation. And the prayer is that is if we persist in that struggle, we will find God in the end. And I'll leave it at that.